Hello and welcome to the Chengdu Living Podcast. My name is Charlie and I'm joined here by Eli and Jacob and Larry from the Natuki Bicycle Shop in Chengdu. Say hello.
Hello.
Hi, I'm Jacob.
I'm Larry.
Excellent. Welcome. We're super excited to talk to you guys about bicycles, Chengdu, and about entrepreneurship and starting your business and starting a successful and very popular business, which has, I think, become pretty famous in Chengdu.
Yeah, I think that we get a lot of really positive feedback from our role here in Chengdu so far since in the almost 3 years that we've been open.
I would say it's well deserved. So let's start with you guys describing just who you are and what Natuki is.
All right. Well, I'm Larry Adamson. I'm from the States. I've been in China now for a little bit more than 7 years, and then in Chengdu, since 2012 when we opened.
I'm Jacob Klink. I'm Larry Adamson's business partner. I've been in China coming on 5 years now, originally in Inner Mongolia. I'm also from Albuquerque, New Mexico, famously known from Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
That's totally true, I think. Yeah, Breaking Bad really puts you guys on the map.
You know me, sometimes I'll be quirky. All right, folks. Simpsons reference. Where did you guys initially meet each other? Did you meet in Chengdu, or did you meet before you guys came out here?
Yeah, no, we met in Beijing, actually. So Jacob was in Inner Mongolia through his first position or his first job in China. I was in Beijing already. And then we met, through the cycling scene there, through Natuki in Beijing.
Right, so Natuki was, before Chengdu, it was a bicycle shop in Beijing, and you met at that bicycle shop, is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
So explain how that happened. You guys meet at Natuki in Beijing, and you share a love and passion for bicycles, and how did that translate into you guys coming here?
Well, when I was first here, I was in Inner Mongolia, which, if you know anything about the geography of it, it's very far north, very... what's the word for it? Just isolated. There's not many people. It's cold. So I have very little opportunities to meet foreigners. In fact, none where I was. So I would come to Beijing to get my little international fix. So I'd take a train down to town whenever I had the chance. And the biggest thing for me was, like, being in Inner Mongolia, there was no cycling. Nobody rode bikes. It wasn't any, like, high-quality bikes. You could buy, like, you know, something from the grocery store that, for a couple hundred kwai, but it wasn't worth it. So, we'd take a train to town, and I would volunteer at the Natuki in Beijing and help them build bikes and just, like, kind of figure out the systems there, like, help them sort out how to get things organized and how to sell things and price them. And it was just that way that through the events that they were also doing in Beijing, like Gold Sprints, which is, like, kind of the stationary sprints, as well as alley cat races and everything, you know, that's how we just ran into each other.
It's Gold Sprints, is that that's a type of bike race then?
Yeah, so Gold Sprints, the way it works, you got two kind of the rollers where you just affix a bike to it, hook it up to a computer, and then set like a distance and see who can sprint it the fastest.
I see, so you're not actually covering terrain in the real world, it's just measuring, it's a machine that measures how far your bike has gone in a particular interval.
Yep, we're in the digital age.
So prior to meeting in Beijing, were you kind of already bike guys? Because knowing you guys here, you're like wizards with the mechanics of a bicycle. Were you like that before Beijing?
Yeah, well, I mean, Jacob has a long history of working in the cycling industry in the States and cycling in the States. Like before in the States was more of just a commuter, like a cycling commuter. And a big thing that we share, kind of in the timing of it being a bit different. But once I got to China, and the first thing I did, this was like in 2007. Like the first thing I did within the first week of being here was get a bike. And what that allowed for me, or what it facilitated, was a degree of freedom that, you know, I have always associated with bikes, but it was so liberating. Like to be in China, most foreigners don't just. It's not their first course of action to go get a driver's license and buy a car or whatever. I mean, so having a bike, you're just completely free to go anywhere and do whatever you want at any time you want. You're not relying on anything else.
Well, China has a really rich history of bike culture. How did you find the bike scene when you got there, both the native Chinese bike scene and the foreign bike scene?
Sad disrepair. I mean, it's not sad. There's a huge push for within the community to kind of like create a westernized recreational industry for cycling that gets more people out for the purposes of fun and for exercise and for utility, but not quite the same that you see in the West. A lot of it here is just sort of like, I have the time, I have the money, so what can I do with it? I'll buy a fancy bike because that's what I've seen in a magazine. Whereas like, you know, the day-to-day use of a bicycle, like of taking it to go to the grocery store, to ride to work, to do any number of things, take your kids to school, whatever it is, it's just not there anymore. Most people just see that as sort of like a, you know, an era gone by, and they don't really see the full utility and convenience of using a bicycle in day-to-day.
What China does have, though, is an amazing infrastructure for bikes. So what I noticed right away upon getting here was that there are bike lanes everywhere. Although, I mean, the use of bikes is not what it, like today, what is not what it was in like the 80s or early 90s, but it's the infrastructure is there. So it's very possible to use a bike and do all the things that you'd need to in a day or, you know, in your life. Like even in Beijing, that's a very sprawling city. It's very navigable by bicycle.
Yeah, and that's one of the great things I think about riding a bike in China versus riding it in the U.S. is that they have divided bike lanes, which adds a degree of safety, whereas in the United States, there's an expectation, I guess regulations differ from one place to another, but often there's an expectation that cyclists are going to be sharing the lanes with cars, and that can be empowering, and it can also be imperiling. If you're riding around with motorists who don't have an awareness for cyclists who may be on the road as well.
Yeah, I mean, for us, a big thing we hope within China is that there won't be the depletion of the infrastructure to the point that it supports automotive culture. So say, for instance, instead of building the cities around being like making sure that everybody has a car, they still allow for, you know, just maintaining and retaining a certain amount of infrastructure for like alternative traffic. That in the future, when you know we hit the curve again and people realize the utility of bicycling, which is, you know, we feel is not like if but rather when, you know, it'll just be a better way to get around.
Yeah, and we already are seeing it a little bit. I mean, among our Chinese, you know, contingent, our Chinese customers, that we often, I mean, recently in the past number of months, we see a not small number of, you know, 40, 50-year-old Chinese people who come in and explicitly say, I'm kind of tired of driving. I'm tired of traffic. And they have the means and the desire and the, and they understand quality. And they are, you know, what we do is, you know, we sell like customized bikes.
Right.
So they can, they see the value in that and they can do it.
I mean, so you guys are really facilitating a lifestyle here. And describe what that entails. So you guys sell custom bicycles. Do you do other stuff as well? Describe what the shop does or what it's like for people who've never been there.
I mean, primarily what we do, I mean, we sell bicycles. So, but what we, I mean, like I said, or we both said a bit ago, is, I mean, we believe that a bicycle is just an incredible machine that provides a level of freedom and independence to the rider that few other things can. You know, so for Jacob and I mean, having been, you know, have the aptitude and knowledge and background of being cyclists, we've always been able to deliver that for ourselves, to build ourselves the ideal bike for our purpose. So our goal in opening a custom bike shop was to be able to first understand a rider and their needs and what they envision their personal, individualized, ideal bicycle to be. Guide them through the process of building it to meet those goals, and then have them participate very closely in choosing the parts, the colors, the, you know, whole slew of components that are available, and then, you know, showing them the process of how it's built and educating them about how to take care of it and how to use it, how to ride it safely, how to use it, you know.
To be a part of the community that exists around that bike culture.
Yeah, we really want to make it attractive. I mean, a big part of it is style. Like, you guys have seen some of our bikes. Like, they're just, you know, an important thing that a lot of people try and wave off is the fact that they want to look good doing what they're doing. So a huge aspect of what we do is we try and match people's choices and give them an opportunity to build something that really suits them so that they can feel like they're a part of the community. A big problem with cycling, you probably know from the West, is like when you think of like a cyclist or like a biker guy, you know, I think of this cartoon that Charlie showed me some time ago. It's like this dude rips his shirt off on a date and he has Bike Life tattooed across his chest. Mm-hmm. The reality is, like, it's intimidating. A lot of people don't, you know, whether they're a novice or just haven't really ridden, they don't see how they can actually become a part of the community in a way that's valuable and can impact the change on their lifestyle.
See right. And you guys have your Bike Life tattoos on your biceps, not on your chest.
My butt, because it's the strongest part of me.
I totally understand what you're saying with a bicycle being a lifestyle thing. I see it the same way. I have bought two bikes from you guys, and they have both kind of changed my life in a not insignificant way. And when I describe your shop or bicycling in China to other people, I describe it in lifestyle terms, that it's not just an item which you buy. It's something which changes the way that you live your life. And one of the major ways it does that is by keeping you out of traffic, which really makes a big difference in enjoying your life, I think, especially in a place like Chengdu, which is facing such a serious traffic problem.
Yeah, I mean, that primarily what we do is sell customized bikes. So we've done just that. I mean, to you, Charlie, and then we have countless stores. We've built hundreds of bikes, just here in Chengdu, and the stories that we have from our customers, like we've had, you know, people come and get their first, you know, high quality bike from us, and then a week later they're out touring Western Sichuan, or you know, just having a really, you know, ideal commuting kind of bike, and them giving us feedback that they now never take any form of public transportation or taxi. They can't get enough of, you know, riding their bike around town. In addition to that, we also like to take on, you know, interesting projects. Like we rebuild a lot of like classic Chinese bikes, and do service for anything. So, it's like we have a constant flow of just any bike. It could be, you know, just a 300 or 400 RMB bike from Walmart that's just doesn't ride well and out of tune. So we'll, you know, service it and get it back running like new. We recently had a customer get she's a mother with a family, or a mother of three. One child can ride a bike and the other two just, you know, ride on her bike. So she got a tandem. Mm-hmm. Off of Taobao, and then we recently gave it a serious upgrade. Went from a single speed to having gears. So interesting projects like that. You know, we do a lot of service.
It seems like one of the unique things about the Natuki bike experience compared to the sort of typical bicycle retail experience where a customer might come in and just get something off the shelf is that you give them a window into the whole process of assembly and introduce them to the different parts that make up their bike and make them really more comfortable with the bike itself. Is that something that is native to the Natuki brand? And when you guys met in Beijing, was that, you know, part of what you guys got from connecting with Natuki, the Natuki shop there?
Yeah, I would say a big thing for us when we went to the Natuki there was the first experience we had in China, like retail, and something that was interesting to us, which is like an active lifestyle sort of, you know, thing, just riding bikes. So a big part of it was the fact that it was just like an integrated part of the community and wanted to provide help beyond just selling you a product. You know, it wasn't just getting the newest, nicest, coolest looking thing. It was getting something that had a value that extended beyond, you know, the bicycle itself. Like, so for us, it's a big part of our vision with bicycling is like, it's empowering. The idea that you can fix your own bike and you can go, you know, we just had friends that both of them just got two new bikes. And both of them just rode to Lushan this last weekend. Mm. They rode their bikes all the way there and back, which is over like about 400 kilometers. And both of them are somewhat novice cyclists, but they did it, you know. And they did it with all, you know, the two legs, you know, a spare tube, and a lot of time. But it's possible. So that's a big thing for us.
How did you guys come to decide that you wanted to open up a shop together? How did you guys decide that you wanted to open up a shop under the Natuki brand name? And how did you guys decide that you would be opening that shop together under the Natuki brand name in Chengdu?
So, I mean, through our experience with Natuki in Beijing, their involvement in their community, like how they interact with their customers, you know, Jacob and I really identified with that. And we, you know, we wanted to not, again, we're very good friends with Enos Brunn, which is the founder of, since in 2009, the founder of Natuki and Flying Banana.
What is Flying Banana?
Flying Banana is the brand of frames and components, like our, the house brand.
You know? Okay.
So with that and our relationship with her and the community in Beijing, we wanted to share what we've been able to do for ourselves with other people, and building the like an ideal bike for the purpose of whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you asked why Chengdu. Well, we did a lot of research around. We decided we were going to open a shop and actualize this dream of ours, and then we looked around the country, figured out where was, you know, I mean, we looked at a bunch of things like the size of various cities, the, you know, economic growth trajectory. It's like the livability.
Mm-hmm.
And Chengdu quickly became, you know, got onto our list, got to the top and stayed at the top. It's a great place. Like this, even, I mean, in 2012 when we did this research, there's a lot of incentive from the central government here to promote the growth of the West.
Mm-hmm.
Was then and is still that way now. This is some of the most amazing cycling terrain and environment in the world. The Tibetan Plateau is really close. It's a great place to cycle. The livability of the city. And the sense of Chengdu people and in the surrounding areas for their attitude towards sports and recreation.
Mm-hmm. A lot of opportunity, a lot of room for growth, and there's a lot of, like, it's bizarre for the size of the city and for its positioning within sort of the tier structure of Chinese cities. Chengdu has an insane amount of creative power. There's a lot of authentic energy that goes into just sort of creative pursuits that shows, and we wanted to tap into that, really.
Well, it's good to know that your objective research confirms what a lot of us had discovered by accident, just the great livability of the city and the prospects for growth and development here.
Well, Larry was the only one who'd ever visited Chengdu before we did this, and I remember we'd picked our top three cities and we were going to do on-site visits. And before we even started, he was like, yeah, I'm just going to be honest, I'm a little biased, you'll see why. And then the first time we landed in Chengdu and just like started riding around, it just became very apparent that this is kind of a place you'd want to be.
Which were the other two cities that were contenders?
Can we guess?
Yeah, go for it.
I'm going to guess
Kunming.
I was going to guess Kunming as well, because I think the West and the sort of money that's earmarked for the development of the West is probably a big factor in the growth of some of these cities. I'm going to guess Kunming, and then I'm going to guess the other one was Xi'an. Those are my guesses.
You got one of them.
Yeah, one of them. The other one was Xiamen.
Xiamen.
Of course, yeah, weather. Kunming and Xiamen got the great weather.
There's actually a large part of it too. There's a lot of cycling manufacture around there, and close trade relations with the. I mean, it's a port, so a lot of
near Taiwan.
Yeah, a lot of transaction with Taiwan. So,
when you guys moved to Chengdu, you guys set up the bike shop, and I understand that you went through the process of opening a WOFE, which for people who don't know stands for Wholly Owned Foreign Enterprise. And that's a type of corporate of company incorporation that a lot of foreigners who try to open up businesses here go through, but can have a lot of procedural and bureaucratic hurdles. What was that process like for you guys when you finally decided to officially set up your company here?
Yeah, I mean it was not without challenges, but it was we consulted with a lot of foreign business owners. particularly ones that were very, you know, seasoned and had a lot of experience and the kind of insight that we were looking to consult with. And yeah, they definitely recommended that that was the way to go. So we researched the steps necessary, the options that we had available in taking that path.
What's involved? Because I have no idea what's involved with registering a Woofie. What kind of things are required for you to do that? Let's say someone wants to open a bike shop. What are the steps that you guys go through roughly?
Well, whether it's a bike shop or anything, I mean, a Woofie, like Eli said, is a wholly owned foreign enterprise. It can be owned by it can be registered by an individual or by a foreign company. Like, we chose the foreign company option for a couple of reasons, but. So
you're a foreign company registered overseas.
Yeah, we have a foreign company registered overseas, and they are the sole investor of the company here, the domestic company in mainland China. So the process, I mean, you have to first have a registered company overseas. They are the sole investing entity into establishing the domestic company. In order to start the process, you need to register capital. Which freezes it, puts it into an account that's registered, but then after that, in order to continue the process, you need to spend a lot of money. So it's a little bit, I mean, for us in the beginning, it was kind of like learning a lot of this process. It seemed a little bit backwards.
You need to spend a lot of money?
Well, you have to, so in order to start the processing, you register this capital, and you're supposed to be the totality of your investment capital into a project, whether mm-hmm. it's a bike shop or any business. It could be a huge factory, like multi-million dollar kind of investment. But then to continue the registration process, you need things like an address. So you have to rent space or, you know, a shop or like a really, like small retail space or a big office or something,
right?
Which requires capital to pay the rent, you know. Mm-hmm. And so there were some things like in that regard. It seemed a little bit like the policy in China is a little bit it's like backwards from the order that things actually have to take place.
Right. So what you're saying is there's a tension between the requirement that you have the capital frozen in account and the necessary liquidity that you need to actually set up the business on the ground here.
Sure. So yeah. So there's a lot of expenses that happen along the way that happen after the registered capital that you allocate for the investment is put into.
And when can you move that capital?
So for us, it took it was just the whole process. It took, so starting the domestic company was, for a Chinese person with a Shenzhen Zheng would take, or a Chinese ID would take as fast as maybe 3 or 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
For us, it was around 9 months, and there was a couple of delays that happened. One, the one like noteworthy one was just for the legal representative of the domestic company, which has to be an individual and can't be a foreign corporation.
Mm-hmm.
The name on the passport,
mm-hmm. right?
It was incompatible with the bank, like the internal system within banks, so it became impossible a number of the largest banks in China for a business account to be established
using the passport of the representative of the Chinese company.
Yeah, there was a discrepancy. Essentially, there was a discrepancy between government issued documents, like the licenses of the business that mm-hmm. use the same person's name,
mm-hmm.
And the way that the bank needed to enter their name in the internal system of the bank. So, because that discrepancy existed, it was irresolvable.
So somebody's name is on your business license, on your yinye zhizhao, right?
Yeah.
And that name, as it's shown in the passport, is incompatible with the banking's internal system requirements for some reason.
Yeah, so check to see if your bank can do lowercase letters before you try and open a bank account.
Yeah,
I don't understand how...
So it was essentially a difference between... So the yinye zhizhao, or the business license, it wrote my name
mm-hmm.
It differentiated between uppercase and lowercase letters. So the first letter of my first and middle name were in uppercase and the remaining were lower.
Makes sense so far.
My passport is all in uppercase. So the bank must follow the passport. But at the same time, for a business account, the Yinye Zhijiao
has to exactly match the way that the name is shown within the bank system.
Yes. So there was a discrepancy, and in
was this unusual for you to run into this during the process, or do you run into a lot of kind of silly nonsense like this?
We run into lots of silly nonsense like this. I mean, we have over time. I mean, it's kind of subsided now. I mean, we're now a few years into it, so we've gone through most things that can come up. But
as you go through that 9-month process, are you in business during then, or are you just like hanging out in Chengdu? What happens during that process?
Yeah, we did get a along the way you get a preliminary Yinye Zhijiao, but yeah, so we were able to start business, but this is all at the same time where the entirety of our investment capital is tied up into this registered account.
Right.
So you don't want to incur a bunch of debts not knowing whether or not you're actually going to be able to pay them off.
Right. Right. Okay. Well, you know, I'm sure that there's a lot of foreigners who come to China with sort of dreams of making it rich, or at least of starting their own business and becoming entrepreneurs. And when they enter into the Chinese bureaucratic system, they face similar setbacks and pitfalls and hurdles. What kind of advice would you give to people who are running into the teeth of that bureaucratic machine for keeping yourself calm in the face of that kind of challenge?
In working before, someone put it to me perfectly. They said, have a patient heart. I think that, like, the essence of it, you have to be very patient and take every sort of hurdle you come across as just like, you know, a new lesson, a new challenge. You can't, I don't know. I was reading the Ask Me Anything with Jesse recently, and somebody asked her, like, what's it like opening a small business? And a big part of, like, you know, her answer to that was just like, you just got to roll with the punches. Yep. Essentially. So for us and what we do, whether it's a small business here in the United States, you know, in South Africa, you name it, like, big part of it is just taking those kind of hurdles you meet with, you know, things being lost in translation, things just not making sense, you know, having conflicting information between different bureaus of the government, people just simply not knowing how to do their job. Like, you have to just take that and just try and try again and just be patient with it. Otherwise, you just start to lose your mind, really.
So congratulations to you guys for successfully making it through that process. Now that it's been a couple years, so it's pretty much smooth sailing from this point. Have things stabilized, or do you still regularly deal with these kind of issues?
Yeah, no. I mean, the administrative and bureaucratic things have definitely stabilized. We have matured in many ways, and we've been through a lot of what can happen. I mean, year after year, a lot of it is repetitive, so we just, you know, a hoop is put in front of us and we jump through it. A hurdle is, we, you know, come across an obstacle of some kind and we just deal with it. And like Jacob said, yeah, it's pointless to get frustrated and expect things to happen, you know, in an efficient way. I mean, it's the same, really. I mean, you know, in the West, or as it is here, it's just, you know, slightly different.
Or, you know, maybe it was that way in the West or in the United States decades ago when free markets really hadn't evolved and there wasn't the good, efficient institutions to regulate those markets. And gradually over time, those things got refined, and China hasn't hit that point yet.
Yeah, a big thing, like, speaking on that level, a big thing for us is like, The sort of experience we try and offer people is like a customer is what we have in line with what our experience is with, like, kind of the customer service culture that exists in the West. It's insanely comfortable, easy. Like, you feel nice after you talk to somebody doing any kind of transaction, whether you go to the bank and talk to a teller or, you know, you have a question about, like, the interest rate on your credit card or you want to buy a pair of shoes, like, usually anywhere in the West, like, you can have a pretty comfortable experience doing that. So we try and, like, duplicate that here. And for us, like, a big challenge on the business end of things is, like, taking all the ruffles that come in and trying to smooth them out so that we don't, you know, piss off our customers, essentially.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your customers. Do you guys cater mostly to a Chinese clientele or to a foreign clientele, or what kind of ratio is the mix?
I mean, the slight majority of our clientele are Chinese people. I mean, it's not like accurately reflective of the reality of the proportions that, mm-hmm. that exist here. I mean, but yeah, I mean, we have a great mix of both. I mean, we see at the events that we hold, we have, yeah, there's a, I mean, we have a really international environment when we, at any of our events, like our Friday Ride or some of the more, you know, irregular events that we host.
And what are some of the typical challenges that you confront with your customers? What kind of attitudes do they come in there with, and how do you try to educate them?
Big challenge we have is like trying to translate our understanding of value and quality to the customers. Like most Chinese consumers are very scrupulous. They're very attentive to not just brands, but like where it's manufactured, the standard to which it's manufactured, why they should be spending their money on something, whether it's, you know, vegetables from the market or, you know, back to shoes, a pair of shoes or a bicycle. Oftentimes they're just very conscientious of what they're spending their money on.
At what price range do your bikes start at? Or how much is someone looking at, like, for a high-quality bike that you sell?
So our, like, a basic, like, a single-speed bike, basic one starts at around $2,900. And then it just goes, yeah, we can, anything from there. I mean, just depending on how customized you want it, how, you know, what kind of bells and whistles you want.
Does that price scare many people away? Or is there a lot of conversation, like, describing how your bike shop is different from other bike shops? Because I understand that your bikes are not, you know, indicative of the average bike in Chengdu.
Originally, it did. Our first year in business here was a huge challenge trying to whittle away at the customer's perception of our price. Like, there was a huge barrier to it. A big thing for us has been word of mouth, the service that we follow up with, like, a sale. And kind of our expertise and know-how and just sort of the standards we hold ourselves to has really fulfilled the value behind our product. So generally speaking, like now when people come in and we speak highly about the stuff that we sell because most of it's stuff that we use ourselves. So when we make a sale, it's really passionate because it's from our own experience that we're telling someone that, you know, this will be of utility of them. It is a very high value, very high quality. And it's changed sort of the mean price level at which we sell bikes. So oftentimes now if someone comes in and is marginally interested, has heard about us, and they get walked through the process of getting a new bike, it's not unheard for people to spend 5,000-6,000 RMB on a bike.
And I'm sure that once you impart that philosophy of quality to your customers and they get to try out the actual product, that you make believers out of them. Have you developed a very loyal customer following?
Sure, yeah. I mean, we get, like Jacob just said, I mean, the majority, or a big percentage anyway, of our customers now are referrals, which is great. I mean, it's how a shop like ours can continue to exist. I mean, with the support of, you know, of our friends and customers and the attendance of our events and things. So yeah, I mean, a big thing that in the beginning where we didn't have the, you know, the reputation around town or didn't have the history, we're now, like, we've been around for a couple of years, so we do. And the more people ride our bikes or have friends that have a Natuki bike, the more they just, yeah, sell themselves. I mean, you get on it and you immediately feel the striking difference from most of the other things available.
I noticed last night I went to Machu Picchu, one of my favorite neighborhood bars, and I think there were at least 5 or 6 Natuki bikes parked there. Yeah, you see them a lot.
We got Machu Picchu covered. We're aiming for the living room next. Going to get Haka after that. It's just, you know, a couple doors down.
And then, what's interesting is that I remember when you opened your shop in 2012, you were competing with a lot of other fixed gear shops that were just emerging out of everywhere, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now they're all pretty much kind of absent. And describe that.
Back in 2012 when we were doing our research, there was really just one other shop that tried to do what we had actually just set out to do in the beginning. Mm-hmm. So this is one area where we've evolved a little bit from away from Natuki and Beijing, mm-hmm. where they still, you know, focus primarily on single speed and fixed gear bikes, mm-hmm. As we did in the beginning. We quickly realized that to be more true to ourselves and in line with how we view bicycles, we needed to expand that mm-hmm. beyond just single speed and fixed gear. And so around the time that we were opening, there popped up a number of them, like over a dozen other shops. Even the old, like the older one in town is, and many of the others, there are still a few still around, but many of them have closed. They didn't really adapt and change with the market demand, and you know, where we definitely saw a change in what people wanted. And you
know. I remember some of those shops would come to your shop to get their bikes fixed.
Yeah. I mean, we very quickly got a reputation around town of knowing our shit. You know, we know what we're doing. We kind of joke around. I even said it to somebody just the other day, like the word no, or we can't do it, or maybe I'm fat, like doesn't exist in our shop. Like there's no project we won't at least, you know, consider doing and really give a good effort into doing. I mean, Jacob and I are just really effective problem solvers.
Yeah. And I'm sure that it's your guys' proactive and positive attitudes that help to build that loyalty and bring back customers and spread word of mouth as much as the great quality of your bikes.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, actually. I mean, this kind of thing is exactly what got us into Bamboo. I mean, back again, really early on in 2012, we had a couple of backpackers show up at one of our events and express their interest in wanting to switch from touring the world as backpackers to cycle touring. Mm-hmm. And they were very particular in how they wanted to make that switch was to do it via a bicycle made out of bamboo. So they asked us if we were interested in helping them do it. Jacob and I had both heard of bamboo bicycles before mm-hmm. and were very interested in helping with the project. And lo and behold, within even a short couple of weeks, our enthusiasm towards wanting to see, you know, what we could do with this material was very intense and palpable, like mm-hmm. in the shop. And now, you know, like 2.5 years later, it's a big part of what we do. I mean, we have kind of a spin-off, you know, company called Source Cycles, where we manufacture custom bamboo bikes.
Mm-hmm. And for people who might not be familiar or might be trying to imagine what a bamboo bike looks like, we're talking about the frame of the bike being made out of bamboo and the other parts being similar to a normal bike?
Yeah, so what we do with bamboo bikes is actually we use a process that is borrowed from the carbon fiber industry in hand laying up the frames using bamboo tubing that's been treated so it won't split, it won't crack, it won't rot. And then we join it using just a high structural integrity epoxy resins. We use natural fiber because that just sort of adds to the style and sort of the sustainable aspect of the bicycle. And just build lugs to join the tubes together. So what you end up getting is a bike that's very similar to carbon fiber and how it rides. But it looks beautiful, just unlike any other bike you've ever seen. It's just very organic and natural and just appealing.
How does a carbon fiber bike ride? Can you describe how riding a bamboo bike is different from aluminum or steel, which I understand are the normal frames that you otherwise would use?
Yeah, I mean, the different materials, it's interesting. To be honest, like a novice cyclist, when they get on a bike, whether it's made out of just like really garbage steel or really high-end aluminum or carbon fiber, or bamboo, sort of the ride quality of it isn't going to carry through as much as you would expect, which is actually a beautiful thing in regard to material science. With bamboo, like if you've ridden and had experience with riding different types of bicycles, you know, aluminum's known for being stiff and light. Mm-hmm. Carbon, steel is known for having some sort of give to it. But also depending on the draw of the tube, and it's one of the most well-researched materials in the world, has any number of qualities. Then you have other materials, carbon fiber, for instance, which is a new sort of space age material, and it has you can kind of craft its qualities depending, but it also has dampening features since it's a carbon fiber material. Depending on the weave and the layup of the frame, you can really craft it so that the bike responds exactly as you want. Again, as a novice cyclist, these are the things that you or I probably wouldn't notice right away. Like, there's a lot of experience that goes into that. And then bamboo is essentially the same. Like, bamboo, when you ride it, has a certain tensile quality. So when it flexes at an exponential grade so that as it, you know, when it first starts to give, it feels sort of soft, and then, you know, it sort of springs back into place. I mean, this is on a scale that the average rider, if you were to hit a pothole, you would never be like, oh my God, this bamboo's springy. But like, if you've ridden a bike enough and have ridden different material bicycles, you'll find that it has a very, very smooth ride quality. Feels like a normal bike, but you get on it and it just sort of hums along. It just sort of takes the buzz out of the road.
Do you guys have a personal preference to what type of bike you prefer to ride around Chengdu or anywhere else?
Yeah, I would say big two for us are well, we both are big into bamboo and also steel. So, I mean, preference-wise, it just comes down to what you're hoping to get for. I also have an aluminum bike that is just beautiful because it's super lightweight and just really, really responsive. So it just depends. I mean, bicycles are the kind of thing that you can, if you spend the rest of your life riding them, you have plenty of time to explore what each type of bike and what type of material and setup and, you know, component configuration has on, like, on the effect, like how it affects the ride quality.
We'll include some of the bamboo bicycle photographs with the show notes. They look really beautiful.
And they've come www.sourcecycles.com.
Yeah, you got some wonderful looking bikes, and they've come a long way. I remember when you first started making them, the joints in particular were kind of bulbous before and kind of had an unprocessed look, and now they look much more sleek.
Yeah, I mean, we were just today, actually, we're building a custom bamboo road bike for a customer, and we had another you know, patron come in and watching what we were doing. We got to talking about bamboo. So yeah, I mean, it's one of the, like, the our evolution through that has been, in the beginning, I mean, we're obviously most concerned with the strength and integrity of things. I mean, it's you know, Jacob and I's standards for bicycles is very high. So a bicycle, I mean, a frame should feel like, or a bicycle built up, I mean, the frame should feel like a frame should feel. It should feel very solid beneath you. It should last a long time. So that was our highest priority in the beginning, was making, you know, bicycle frames that had a very, very high integrity. We didn't spend a whole lot of attention to the aesthetic in the beginning, because, I mean, that wasn't our goal at the onset. Once we achieved the integrity, like the level of integrity that satisfied us, then we started to pay attention to some of the aesthetic components of it. And yeah, we've been able to make a lot of improvements. So now, not only are our bikes really strong and they last a long time, some of our frames have been toured on across Asia for tens of thousands of kilometers, and we've also been able to, you know, really tweak the aesthetic and make them look really pretty.
I like the fact that you touched on aesthetics, because I think for a lot of people, and especially maybe some younger riders, fashion is a big part of bicycle culture, both in the United States and in China. You mentioned briefly earlier the fixed gear bike fad craze that was really, really popular in the U.S. for a long time, and then kind of swept through China, where you would see single speed bikes, particularly in very loud fluorescent colors, proliferating around town. Is that something that you still see a lot of? Do you think that trend has started to fade? And how do you see aesthetics and fashion generally within biking? Do you think that that's like kind of a undermines the, you know, the utilitarian ethos that it should be about? Or do you think that the fashion side and the practical side are always going to coexist?
No, fashion's important. It's like, I mean, you wouldn't be able to tell it by looking at me, but like, fashion to the average person, like your style, what you wear, the things you use, like the brands you choose, no matter, you know, how much you deny the fact that you're, you know, a little consumer, these things do speak in some behalf about the kind of person that you are. So to take that fashion and incorporate it into your life and acknowledge that choice, is super important. And personally, like, there has been kind of a dip in the trend, right?
Well, for a fixed gear alone, sure. It's we kind of like to look at it. It's more than you know, just declined. It's kind of equilibrated.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, I mean, you asked a minute ago, like, what our, you know,
competition.
Well, the bike of choice is. So for me, like, the bike I ride around in the city, you know, whether it's made of bamboo or steel or aluminum, will always be a fixed gear.
Mm-hmm.
I just love the intimacy of that feeling.
And for the uninitiated, what exactly is a fixed gear?
So a fixed gear bike is has, like, it's related to just the drivetrain. So many people think about a fixed gear bike as one that doesn't have brakes, but that the braking system and the drivetrain system on a bicycle are completely separate and have nothing to do with one another. All of our bicycles have installed brakes on them, whether mm-hmm. they're fixed gear, single speed, geared, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
A fixed gear is one where the cog that receives the chain on the rear wheel is fixed to the hub, which is the part of the rear wheel that holds the bearings, which means as you pedal forward, the rear wheel spins forward. If you stop pedaling, if you stop moving the crank around, the rear wheel will stop spinning. And if you were to pedal backwards, the rear wheel would spin backwards. So it's fixed. There's no free independent motion of the rear wheel
mm-hmm.
in relation to the crank and the pedals.
So there's no coasting.
There's no coasting. Yeah.
So you like to ride.
What fixed gear does is, I mean, it connects you as a rider through the bike and the drivetrain to the road
mm-hmm.
in a way that is not comparable with other freewheeled bikes, whether they're geared or single speed.
I've noticed this also. I remember 2 years ago when you made the first bike for me, you described fixed gear to me, and it had been a new thing to me. And you described it in the same terms. You said it connects you with the road. It's kind of a more intimate cycling experience. And I tried it out and have never gone back.
Yeah. 2 weeks ago, we had a customer who came in. He fell in love with cycling. He came to our shop and got a bike and just, like, really found it to be his passion. Just getting around, ripping around town on a bike, it just became a part of what he did. And so he recently got a new bike, and when he got the new bike, he was just like, man, this is kind of corny to tell you this, but, like, fixed gear, it's like, everybody says this, I know it's corny, but, like, fixed gear is like a zen thing, man. You're on the bike, and you feel the pedals, and you feel the road, and you just feel connected with life and eternity and the future, and my God, my mind's blown. I was just like, right on, dude, because that's it. Like,
that's the ecstatic experience that that the bike rider can aspire to.
Yeah, it's just like, it's the feeling of you on the bike and the world around you, and that's it. You know, fixed gear is sort of just a different mode to have access to that, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I still have a touring bike that if I'm going to ride in the mountains a long distance for multiple days, like, I will take that. I have a road bike that's real racy and sporty and puts me in a real aggressive position. If I'm going to, you know, ride with a group of friends and go on like a 100-plus kilometer ride for exercise, like, I'll take that. We have rental bikes at the shop that we'll occasionally borrow ourselves that have baskets on them and things. So if I go to the store to get stuff or go around the corner to get lunch, like, I'll take that one. I mean, we have the luxury of having a shop and having a fleet of bikes that we can have access to all the time, but my bike of choice, if I'm going to rip around town and zip through traffic and need to get from the south, second ring road to the north, first, whatever, it will be, yeah, the fixed gear. Because right. It's just...
So maybe that trend was not just about aesthetics, it was also something about the riding experience that will persist even if
we wanted to ride that wave, so to say. Like, we were hoping honestly that fixed gear would be kind of, you know, this creation of a new generation of cyclists. Like, create a trend in cycling, because that's what it did for both of us. Both of us, like, had cycled in the past, but fixed gear really just drew us into the experience and then to the community of cycling, and we grew from that. And I think for Natuki, it was the potential of being able to use this trend to capture a new audience that could be moved by bicycles and just start to explore them further.
And then what became possible through the fixed gear boom, with the customizability and choosing your color and the color of the components and everything, we've now adapted that to any kind of bike.
Yeah.
So we can build road bikes which afford the customer the same ability to choose their own frame color, put a logo or design on it of their choice, can you know choose the color of the of all of the components that go along with it, and it can be any kind of bike, a road bike, touring bike.
I think that that customization is really key to captivating the interest of that young, middle class Chinese bicycle consumer. There's been a lot made of sort of the growing Chinese middle class and the way that they're going to spend their disposable income. And I think bikes are a real great prospect for areas that people are going to spend their additional disposable income because they're cool and they're useful.
Yeah, I mean, it gives them a remarkable way to be unique, to put their own kind of stamp on something. It is an expression of their ability to spend, you know, kind of like their... You know, having a really just nice stuff, it's recognizable. I mean, when you put like a Brooks leather saddle on any bike, it immediately looks really nice.
Yeah. Big part too is like if I said this before, it's not a matter of if but when. Like realistically, like in the West and a lot of places, like car culture has hit somewhat of a critical mass, right? So many people are driving cars and they're kind of upset about being bound financially and just geographically by the confines of using an automobile. And I think that'll happen a lot quicker in China because realistically in a city of 7 million people living in such a small area, not everyone can own a car. And I think even if half the people owned a car, just the amount of traffic and congestion and just like inconvenience of owning a car is gonna just drive people's attention away towards other alternative forms of transportation, including bicycles.
Well, you know, having sung some of the praises of owning a bike and using a bike to get around Chengdu, I think we would be remiss if we didn't touch on some of the challenges about biking around in the city as well, with which I'm sure you guys are very well acquainted. Maybe you could tell us just a little bit about how you guys tackle the challenges of safety, both personal safety for riders as well as the safety of your bike as a piece of property, keeping it safe in a city full of thirsty bike thieves.
All right, well, first, that's another issue that a lot of people bring up. I mean, our bikes are not, it's an investment. Mm-hmm. They're very high quality, and yeah, they come along with, you know, a price tag. To avoid that, I mean, in China, it's actually pretty straightforward, is to get a good quality lock and religiously use that high quality lock to lock the bicycle frame to an immovable object.
Mm-hmm.
It may not be convenient. You may get a little bit of grief from the security guard monitoring or the attendant monitoring the bicycle place or where you're supposed to put bikes. But by doing it, you know, every time, it's the possibility of theft or like the likelihood of theft becomes nearly negligible.
I remember once you explained, I think, a mathematical formula that you suggest to customers to spend a certain amount of money on a lock in relation to the bike. Is that...
Well, because a lock is essentially a one-time insurance premium. You can't, you know, there's no insurance company that will insure bicycles against theft, to my knowledge anyway. So you make an investment in a lock. Usually our kind of benchmark is somewhere between like a fifth and sixth of the bicycle, the whole bicycle's price, would be theoretically justified. I mean, locks usually don't cost quite that much, or even like a good quality lock doesn't cost quite that much. But using a lock that was given to you for free by the bike shop where you bought a, you know, 800 or 900 RMB bike, you know, they're just of such a low quality. Sometimes they can be pulled open without a tool.
Mm-hmm.
Or can be cut with a 10 RMB tool that you can buy, you know, within a 10-minute walk from nearly anywhere in an urban environment in China. So, yeah, I mean, it's with just common practices of locking your bike to an immovable object with a quality lock.
I also find that taking advantage of all of the lots that are attended is a really good way to do it. There's a lot of places in China, if you look around in the various xiaoqu, the various residential developments or behind commercial buildings, you can often find a lot that is attended by somebody. And your down payment of one kuai or two kuai that you pay for that person to watch your bike is a pretty good investment in the safety of your vehicle.
Yeah, for us, that's not good enough still. Like, mm-hmm. a lot of people, like, anytime you think like my shit won't get stolen, it's gonna get stolen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all it takes is any opportunity you can that you need to leave your bike unattended, you just lock it to something. Give yourself the ultimate like security, knowing that you tried to do your best to prevent bike theft, which usually is enough. Yesterday two people came in and they both had these like kind of crummy bikes and they were just like, yeah, I don't get my stuff stolen, like I don't have to worry about it. And then they're still going to feel really bad when they come out one day and they find their bike's been stolen, because that attitude got their bike taken away.
A madman who says that.
Yeah.
Bike thieves will go to amazing lengths to achieve their goal here, is what I found.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure you got a good story about that.
It's a heartbreaking story. I do. The first bike which I bought from you was stolen outside of my apartment. But I broke the rule. You know, as you guys say, the rules must be followed religiously.
Yeah.
And, as extraordinary the circumstances of my bike being stolen were, you know, it was in my apartment on the fourth floor behind a guard. It was not locked.
Yeah.
And I can't even imagine actually how someone got it out of there.
It was in my bedroom, it was actually in the bed with me. I had my arm around the bike.
All but that, essentially. Yeah. And it was still stolen. So if you don't follow those two rules, I feel like there's no guarantee at all that your bike is safe.
Yeah. I mean, it is just a matter of religiously following those rules of having a quality lock and always, always, always locking it to something. Even if you're going to go in somewhere for a few minutes, or if you're sitting outside or in a cafe and feel like, oh, I can just see it outside, I'll keep an eye on it. It's that instant that you're not looking at it that it's gone. And then other habits, like where you go often, you know, where you live, like in the Xiaoqu where you might live, or where you go to work, making sure in particular in those places, like places where people have an opportunity to know your habits of when you're going to leave your bike there, how long you're going to be away. It's those kinds of situations that bikes tend to disappear. But once it's the frame is locked to something immobile, the likelihood it becomes nearly irrelevant.
Yeah, bike theft is a crime of convenience.
Yeah. The other thing that you mentioned about safety, like riding in China. I mean, a couple of things. I mean, our many years riding in China, whether it's here in Chengdu or in other cities in China, there's some kind of just some conventions that might be different from the West that I think if people were more aware of or paid attention to, it dramatically increases the safety of riding in China. The key one in particular is the concept of right away.
Mm-hmm.
In the West, whether it's Europe or North America or wherever, right of way is understood to be your right to the forward direction. Right? Where in China, although legally it might be similar, what it actually is in convention is...
Who's less afraid of death?
Well, who's in the way first, actually? So even police, when there's like mediations going on to resolve like a disagreement of an accident, really what it is whoever is in the way first has the right of way. So mm-hmm. this is why, for example, you see things at stoplights where cars pulling, like turning left, will just jut out in front of each other.
Right.
The oncoming traffic doesn't get mad. It's the convention here. So they're in the way first, so they have earned the right of way because they got in the way first. So the same thing applies to bicycles. I'm not saying like play chicken with a bus or do explicitly unsafe things, but understanding that, you're like how right of way works.
Right.
It really influences your notion of how to navigate around roads.
Once you learn that basic step, from then on moving forward, it's pretty straight and easy. I mean, there's oftentimes people get very frustrated with horns here, but horns are just indicators. They're not used in an aggressive manner at all. It's not to express somebody else's rage at what you've done. Generally, it's to say like, hey, I'm near you, and you didn't look for me. So you'd be surprised that if you're riding down the road or driving down the road or doing whatever on the road, as long as, you know, you're paying attention to the sounds around you, you can generally get by with a very just haphazard, you know, just forward-minded approach. Like, I don't know, it's kind of sad. My habits have changed such that, like, I don't regularly check my shoulder anymore when I do maneuvers in the traffic that require that I go left or right and have to, you know, kind of be mindful of other lanes of traffic. But that's a big thing, you know. If you put a bell on your bike and just ding the hell out of it, it's very useful, which is somewhat surprising.
I think one of you recommended a bell on my bike, and it has just been the most useful thing ever. I use it like 10 times anytime I ride anywhere. There are pedestrians just walking all over the place, people not paying attention to intersections.
Yeah, I mean, I think it comes from, I mean, it took having a few, like some of our friends and family visiting us to see or hear it said in their words. Like, China is a socialist country.
Mm-hmm.
So as a socialist country, it's your job to look out for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also everyone else's job to look out for you. So, and you know, we're no different. We're here participating. Yeah. So
right.
When you're on the road, it's your responsibility to look out for everybody around you and not to hit them. So if there's a car or if there's a pedestrian or somebody in your way, like, go around them. Like, they're expecting you to look out for
right.
them.
Right, in America, America is a society of individual rights. So in America, if somebody cuts you off when you're in the intersection going forward and they want to turn left and they cut you off, people in America will crash into you just to prove a point because it's a matter of principle.
Yeah.
And in China, that would seem unheard of. I think, actually, you guys make a really great point, which is that as travelers and pedestrians and people, bicyclists, we all have a sort of obligation that's incumbent upon ourselves, a responsibility to familiarize ourselves with the cultural context of the traffic universe.
Yeah.
And even something like a horn, which seems incredibly automatic and intuitive, what it means, it's actually, your reaction to it is kind of acculturated. In the United States, a horn is like an insult. But in China, a horn sometimes is just like a, hey, I'm coming by you, you know?
Yeah. Well, most recently, I was riding with somebody, and they actually, this guy on a Dianping Trail, like an e-bike, came scooting up behind him, clipped him, and just almost threw him off his bike. And after that, the guy slowed down and started screaming at him. He was just screaming at my buddy. He was like, you gotta pay attention to where you're turning. I was like, you need to use your bell, sir. And he was like, you're right. And then the next time he went scooting past us, he was bam, 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 bam. And I was like, there you go, buddy. Like, and it was the weirdest, like, kind of cultural flip I'd ever had, because I used to be so annoyed by bells.
Yeah, you're like, you should honk more.
Yeah, I was like, you need to be honking, dude. Like, come on. Like, it's the middle of the night. Lay on it.
Yeah, you know, I actually ride a Dianping Trail around town, and whenever I pass somebody, I try to give them essentially two honks. One honk is when I'm coming up from behind, which is a courtesy honk, which is like, I'm coming up behind, and then when I pass, there's one more honk, which is like, I'm coming right by you right now.
Yeah.
Another thing that I learned for the first time after years of riding and, you know, participating in traffic, is I actually looked up Chinese traffic law. And it turns out one thing that is a noteworthy that surprised me is the laws related to the various lanes in traffic. So in urban environments in particular, what's of paramount importance is flow. So any way that traffic can keep flowing is okay. This is why, for example, you rarely see police officers ticketing people for riding the wrong way on a one-way street, or when you see vehicles in what we would call like the bike lane. What's often what we would call the bike lane is actually just like a, I mean, in some roads where it's like a dedicated lane, it's actually referred to as like the service lane. So, which means that traffic can flow in either direction on it, and it's just for the convenience of anybody to get to those businesses along the side of the road. In the bike lane, if there's cars parked there, they just happen to be parked there. If there's cars going in it because the traffic and the main lanes of traffic are blocked up, that's okay because traffic is still flowing. If it's all backed up, then that road has just reached its capacity. But the attitude that any one entity, like cyclists, have a right to the bike lane, or cars or bicycles shouldn't be in the main, you know, main lanes of traffic, are Western ideas that don't apply here. What's most important is flow. So if there's cars in the bike lane, just, you know, it's totally okay and legal for a bicycle to just go around them or go into lanes of traffic and go around them, as long as things are flowing.
So we're coming right into summer of 2015. Is this the high season for bicycles? What's going on looking at the next couple months for you guys? Do you guys have any special activities coming up or hopes for summer, alley cats, group rides, anything like that?
Yeah, this summer is going to be hectic. We got a lot planned. A big thing is, like, coming up in June, we start our kind of customer appreciation month, where previous customers, if they introduce like somebody to the shop and get them involved in the community, we extend like discounts. This is accompanied with other promotions. We also are planning on doing, we were talking today with someone about organizing an alley cat. An alley cat is, just for those that are the uninitiated, an alley cat's kind of like a scavenger hunt. It's just kind of a free-for-all citywide bicycle race. At the beginning of the race, you're handed a manifest, which includes any number of checkpoints. Those checkpoints can be anywhere in the city. You don't know where they are until just before you set out, which is really exciting and fun, and it's a great way to learn the city if you don't know your way. A big part of it's not your technical ability as a rider, but also leans heavily on your know-how of the city and how to get around, essentially. So there's that. We also have in the works, we're planning on doing workshops, in particular to get people involved in just bicycle maintenance, basic things like how to fix tubes, if they get a flat, just basic bicycle maintenance courses.
That's great.
Yeah. So there's a lot on the plate, but yeah. we're hoping to expand it.
Our regular Friday ride has gotten to be quite popular.
Yeah, I don't think we've described that. Because that's one of my favorite things in Chengdu. I always take visitors who come to Chengdu on the group ride. Describe what that is.
So we've been doing it now for a couple of years. We just had our 100th ride. It's like a weekly event that we do. So it was our 100th ride was just earlier in March. April, where everyone meets at the shop. We hang out for a little bit. It's like socialized chat. It's a great way to meet people. And then a little bit after 8, we set out with a cargo bike we have rigged with speakers, and we play music, and then just kind of mosey through the city in a big group listening to a good collection of music. We'll. The route usually isn't more than like 13 or 14 kilometers, and then we'll stop somewhere midway, have a refreshment or something, and then before we continue back on and then finish at the shop.
So that's Friday nights, 8 p.m. at your bike shop.
Yeah, which is on Xiaotiandongjie.
Yeah,
in Yulin.
And we will put the information for the location of your bike shop as well as your WeChat information up on the show notes for this page. I'd just like to say, you guys have been a great member of the Chengdu community, and it's been wonderful to see you guys grow and to see you support the development of other social institutions and Chengdu Living and other restaurants and just the broader expat community here in the city.
Yeah, I mean, for us, like, we're really excited to see the potential of Chengdu's active lifestyle community be met. There's a lot of cool things that are happening here. whether it's Sino Stage and Dance. You know, there's a lot, any number of other like minor dance courses that I've heard of. There's, you know, a lot of sports activities, and we're just hoping to become a big part of it and get more people out riding, essentially.
How can people stay up to date with what you guys are up to? So obviously people should visit your shop. It's just outside of Yulin. How else? You guys are on WeChat. You have a website. Describe where people can find you.
Yeah, I mean, social media, like our WeChat is a big one. Our Weibo, which is, I mean, mainly in Chinese, but where WeChat is in both languages predominantly. I mean, our website, natuki.com. They can, you know, stay.
And the new website for the bamboo bikes.
Yeah, the new website.
www.sourcecycles.com.
Sourcecycles.com.
Yeah. So we've got a website for that. We also, for both of everything, we got Facebook. We don't have Twitter or Instagram. We had Instagram, but that's been blocked access lately. You can also, keep your eye out. We do a lot of just old school paper flyering, so you'll see our posters up and around. You'll see leaflets, handouts. You know, they're apparently a hot item at Johnny Five's. So,
excellent. So, as a closing question, I would like to ask, what's your favorite bicycle-related song?
That's exactly what I was thinking.
So, you guys can each pick one.
Yeah,
a bicycle song.
Good cycling tunes. Cycling
songs
tunes.
You like to cycle.
You guys
to.
Are riding around the city. It's a sultry summer evening. You know, you just had a couple libations. You're feeling good. Your shirt is unbuttoned a little bit. Your hair is blowing in the wind. You got some tunes blasting on the speakers. And
can we pick an album? Would that work?
No, a song.
Yeah,
song.
I mean, a song that has a definitely a, you know, soft place, or it resides in a very, like, you know, warm place in our hearts around the shop and on the ride is Yes Sir.
Yeah, Yes Sir.
Who's the song by?
Bacara. She's a 70s disco queen.
Okay, perfect. Got it. Thank you so much for recording this with us. We really enjoyed this conversation. I hope you find some new customers and some new friends through this podcast, and I'm sure that people will be very lucky and happy to meet you and be introduced to your shop and your bicycles.
For the listeners, thanks. And if you want to find out any information about us or what's happening in the community, check out Chengdu Living and ChengduPlaces.com. Those are valuable resources.
Ding ding.
If you want more share.